We are looking so forward to having you here a couple of days at Purdue. Is it nice to have residencies like this where it's just not a one-off, but you're here a couple of days?
Oh, certainly. You know, by all means. I mean, coming to do a residency is literally that. I think it's not just residence in terms of where you're located, but just in terms of, I think especially if you have a musical message that you want to get across that has a lot of, you know, that's meaningful to you in a sort of extra musical way, then by all means, you want to share that with people. And I'm looking as forward as you are, if not more.
And when you come up with these things, I know presenters will sometimes say, oh, can you focus on some Baroque music or whatnot? Or is it sometimes that you get this, you know, big plate because you do such a wide range of music? How is it to choose programs like this?
Well, you know, I got pretty carte blanche, basically. I mean, I think there was an understanding that I would kind of mix up things in the program. Well, you know, it's funny, the whole idea of playing modern and older music kind of started when I remember having a conversation with someone, I think it was a musician, who said, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to go to a museum and see completely new and old masters next to one another? And I remember thinking, no, that's a terrible idea. And she said, well, why? And actually, I couldn't come up with a good answer. So I thought, well, okay, I guess I'll experiment in the concert hall. So that's really where it started. Was I couldn't come up for proving why my friend was wrong, and it turned out that she was very right. So that's really been the whole reason for this. And I think, well, of course, it makes me play the older music very differently. You know, I see these composers in a different light. I see them in a, if you like, maybe it's slightly facile to say, but I see them in a more living light.
Yeah, and I imagine it brings excitement when you do find new J.C. Bach pieces, you know, that it's like, sure. Oh my gosh, you know, here's something, if you want to make the art sort of a comparison, that, you know, here's something that maybe a collector had for a long time or, you know, was in the back of the closet and suddenly we have a new painting.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so in that sense, old music is new. I mean, I don't know, these linear concepts of music and music history are, I don't really know when they started, but certainly in the 18th century, they would have been thought as, you know, pretty absurd, actually.
I have sort of a banal question for you. When you come here and when you head off to China or where you get back from Germany, are you taking your own instrument? Are you?
Oh, that's not a banal question at all. It's a question that gets asked a lot. No, of course, I don't take my own instrument. I mean, I do not have the logistic gift for that sort of thing. It would be nice to, because I had an instrument recently built with carbon fiber and it has all these great bells and whistles, and it would be wonderful to, but you know, that's just a logistical nightmare. Also, I have to say, I don't know if this is really appropriate for radio, but in a way, playing a different instrument each night is kind of like spending the night with someone new.
Oh, wow.
And that's exciting. Probably shouldn't say that, but here we are.
No, that's, you know, it makes sense, though, because, I mean, it's, you know, travel these days is hard enough alone, more or less trying to, you know, take a incredible instrument and usually one that takes so much tuning and whatnot. So, I was just a little curious about that. Mm. When you do travel, obviously, there has to be time in the hall and sort of things. Is it that you rely on a lot of technical folks to get it tuned? Or I know that sometimes, you know, if in the midst of a concert, you're like, oh, my gosh, you know, this is something that needs to be taken care of. Are there some technical things that happen?
Well, you do, of course, depend on a technician. I think any keyboardist will tell you that their technician is really their lifesaver. So you should really stay on their good side. Fortunately, most technicians are very easy to get along with as people. But actually, in the case of time in the hall and things like that, look, I mean, here's the thing. In the case of the harpsichord, you have a string being plucked, right? So the height of what's going to pluck the string and the distance between the quill and the string is so infinitesimal. But those little gradations can be extremely frustrating if they're not, well, I mean, I was going to say if they're not what you're used to, but there's nothing that I'm really used to because I'm always traveling. But I mean, you are really spending the time saying, okay, I have a musical message in my head. How am I going to affect that musical message with this specific instrument, with whatever its technical characteristics or traits really are? And that's a whole project, really.
you not only play such a wide range of music, you actually do presenting. I love being able to listen to you, and I've heard all sorts of NPR and BBC great features. Is that a passion? Is that something like, you know, you did, sort of happened into? How do you get into a bit of broadcasting?
Do you know, broadcasting, it happened in two ways. I was the kind of guy who used to yell at the radio when I heard something I didn't like. So not in terms of playing, but in terms of what people would say. So I finally thought, okay, you know, it's great to be a complainer, but either you, what do? Either you go on Twitter and you abuse that person, which is a bit stupid, or you actually see whether you can do better. And actually, one really good thing for me was that it taught me that, you know, broadcasting is really hard work. You know, it takes a great deal of preparation, and it takes a cool head to do it. So it actually made me respect broadcasters much more getting into it myself. And kind of, I learned to give them a, you know, maybe easier time to some extent. But also, you know, it's really about controlling the message, if that makes sense. I mean, it's also why I write program notes. You are controlling the message around what you do artistically. And you're making sure that a unified message is being sent that has all the right information, you know, that has all the assumptions that playing that instrument and playing that music deserves, I think. So broadcasting helps.
I love the different sort of programs, whether it's solo or chamber music. I see all these, you know, lovely pieces by Bach with Jennifer and doing music with Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Is it fun to sort of have this whole recital chamber music and orchestral soloist sort of career?
What's funny, I mean, I always thought that my recital would be basically a recital. Excuse me. Let me start again. Funny enough, I always thought that my solo career would be basically a recital career, because how many people would call you for harpsichord concertos? But funny enough, here we are a few years later, and I'd say probably 50% of my time, maybe, I don't know, maybe 40% of my time is spent with concertos. And not just concertos like, I don't know, Bach concertos or things, but a lot of modern concertos, a lot of sort of 20th century classics. And yeah, that's very unexpected, and of course naturally that's exciting, and you feel very lucky to do it, and then people see the instrument in another context, and maybe that also helps send a message that the instrument isn't somehow defective.
As you travel around the world, I experience sort of the difference between sort of a chamber music audience and an orchestra audience. Do you find different audiences, whether you're in Europe, America, responses?
I feel, probably a controversial thing to say, I feel perpetually misunderstood in the United States. Because I'm always curious what it is people are listening to, or whether they're listening, if that makes sense. So one occasionally feels the need, or perhaps one is demanded by the audience in the United States to slightly underline points a bit more than one would elsewhere. But of course, people listen differently. I mean, for example, in China, people respond very much to the moment in music. So if something really interesting happens in a specific moment in a piece of music, you will actually see people laugh, or people will make a reaction, or if something really virtuosic happens, someone takes a photo with their phone. And so the Chinese are very plugged into the moment of performance. Whereas maybe Germans or the English sort of absorb things over the long arc of the evening, the long arc of the concert. I feel, by and large, Americans come from a place of doubt, which I know is a terrible thing to say, but I mean, kind of that there's an assumption that the harpsichord isn't really a real instrument. And then hopefully by the end you've won them over, and that's really nice. And then you feel like you have 200 or 300 or 500 more people on your side, you know, and which itself is a very fun endeavor.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things. I think you're going to change some hearts and minds here, and as folks listen more and more. It's hard these days because we're in such a sound clip world, and such a, you know, viral video has to be 90 seconds sort of thing. Not, you know, anything over 3 minutes is, you know, and that's very contradictory, unless you're listening to a very small fugue, Prelude Fugue by Bach. You know, that's quite different from our industry.
That's right. I think that's a tremendously good point. Well, again, if you're going to play on different instruments and be excited by that, then you're going to have to deal with different audiences. And that is, you know, that is, if you like, that is the work that we've chosen. You know, it's the life that we've chosen. So
I guess I've fallen into a crutch, but I think it's a good question. Is what would you say to someone that, you know, has never experienced harpsichord? What would you say to them to encourage them to come to one of these
concerts? I would say come with no assumptions. And if you didn't enjoy it by the end, come and tell me. Most people are afraid of the prospect of really telling a classical artist what they thought. So I say, come and tell me. And that helps.
Yeah, I've heard from composers, you know, say, you know, I hate it when they say it was interesting. You know, it's like, no, tell me something, you know, like.
Yeah, tell me something. Exactly. And I think we have to have our critical faculties on with classical music. That's important for anything. That's important for, I don't know, piano music or Beethoven or Franck or Elliot Carter or whatever. We have to have our critical faculties on. Just because something is old, it doesn't mean everything old was good. You know, a lot of things that were old, that were bad. A lot of things that don't speak to us. And then we have to, of course, our society is very different from their society. So we have different ways of expressing things. This idea that we could express it and that you could hear it in the same way as they did is, it's mendacious. I mean, it's a lie. And that's just not on. But of course, the presentation of earlier music and Baroque music, particularly in the United States, was largely a sort of amateur affair. And it was largely a contrarian affair. You know, people, I think, who were maybe frustrated with the mainstream of classical music or felt like they didn't belong, they gravitated toward that. And, you know, and their anxieties sort of feed into that, for better or worse. So, of course, you have to contend with that. And again, I'm not saying this is a negative thing. I mean, this is actually quite, you know, it's quite enjoyable to deal with a completely different set of circumstances, I guess you could say.
Well, it's rare that I get to tell someone that, you know, your recording changed my life, but Time Present and Time Past was just such a revelation. It was so nice when I was in Austin to get this. And, you know, we adore the recordings, both that were out on DG and now back to Harmonia Mundi with all these.
I'm back to Hyperion.
Yeah. Pardon me. with the Passing Measure. So it's just lovely. Any future endeavors you can tell us?
Yes, sure. Well, later this year, I will start to release my recordings of the complete Bach, which will come out one a year. And it's starting with the 7 toccatas, which is BWV 910 to 916, in case you're keeping count. And the 7 toccatas is a good place to start because Bach wrote them when he was young and when he was full of the tendency to show off a lot. So I quite enjoy that. And then in July, I'm recording an album, which will come out, I guess, at the end of the year or maybe next year, which is of new and electronic music. And so that'll be a lot of fun, but I'll also have some classics in it. Like there'll be, well, classics from a modern perspective. I mean, I'll be recording Henry Cowell's set of four from 1961, Toru Takemitsu's Rain Dreaming from 1986. There'll be Kaya Sarriaho's Jardin Secret 2 from 1988. So, you know, that interspersed with some music that's been written for me, including a piece that has harpsichord and ebows, which is something you might see guitarists use. But actually on harpsichord strings, they're very effective. And so that'll be that album. And then next year I'll record all of Klavier Übung 1 and 2 of Bach, which is all of the partitas, French overture, Italian concerto, that sort of thing. So, you know, keeping busy.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. Well, safe travels, toy toy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really look forward. Thank you. And I look forward to, you know, people coming up and talking after the concert and asking questions.